We are at 7:30, so I am going to go ahead and mute all. And as always, everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Remute yourself afterwards. And welcome to any new people we have with us tonight. As always, we welcome anybody as a guest at any of our meetings. You're free to join in any one of them. If you want to join, you can just come to our website and click the Join or Renew button on the toolbar at the top, and it'll lead you through your princely sum of $20 a year to join the group. So we'd be happy to have you join, but feel free to continue to come as a guest if you so desire. And later on this evening, the presentation in PDF format and the audio track and the contents of the chat will go up on our website for your later review. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Now, we have a number of topics tonight, but I think we're going to have time for questions at the end, so let's see how we go.
Yeah, start thinking about them now, folks.
So we're always interested in people's favorite applications for Windows and Linux and Android devices. And some time ago, somebody asked about the sound editor Audacity. And I actually have used Audacity for quite a long time, so I'm going to give a really brief review here. And the neat thing about Audacity, as far as I'm concerned, is that it's available for both Windows and Linux. So it's a multi-platform program that I can use in both places. I started using it quite a long time ago. This is going back basically 20 years here. I had this article in the newsletter when I was transferring music from vinyl LPs in those days to CDs. And basically by buying this, by buying one of these cables here, which was RCA jacks that plugged into the receiver on my hi-fi system to a 3.5 mil jack that plugged into the sound card, then you had basically a connection between the vinyl LP and being able to create a digital music file. So these days, of course, you don't have to use vinyl LPs. Here we have Audacity, basically lined up to record the sound, at least from a YouTube video. And you can see there that you're getting the sound file in stereo with the blue waveforms there. So all you really need to do with Audacity, it's a free and open source software. So you just install it, and then you just go to Edit and Preferences, and if you choose the audio settings, then all you have to do is set it so that it's accessing the computer's sound card. So here I've got it connected to the speakers and to a microphone, which is part of the laptop computer. So once that's done, then you just record the information. It's a pretty flexible system. It's got lots of different controls. One of the things you can do here is, if you notice at the bottom there, you can drag the bottom of that window down so that you basically fill the window with the actual waveform. So that gives you a bit more real estate there that's useful. And in the top corner there, you've got these plus and minus signs, and that basically expands the timeline. So here, I've got the whole hour and 15 minutes probably of this is a Q&A recording file. And so there's an hour and 15 minutes on the timeline here. But if I hit plus, then I can spread out that waveform and be able to zoom in on individual portions of the sound file. Because basically what I want to do is I want to be able to play it. And you notice in the top left-hand corner here, you've got the regular, DVD-type play controls, media player controls. And you've got go forwards and stop and pause and accelerate forwards and backwards. And here's the record button if you want to actually record a sound from somewhere else. And the other thing you can do is you can easily move along the 1 hour's worth of sound recording here by basically taking the slider and dragging it up and down, and the counter here will tell you basically where you're up to. So this is actually a Q&A recording, and one of the things I want to do is chop off all the front chit-chat, which is not necessarily related to Q&A. There's lots of interesting conversation goes on, but there's no pretty pictures to go with it, the PowerPoint slides. So I basically chop off the front end. So what I'm doing is I'm looking for like 15 minutes or so, which is generally where around about where the time is. And if I find my 15 minutes and a bit here, and if I click the mouse in the middle, in the waveform here, then that basically positions the cursor. So if I were then to play the sound recording, it would play forwards from that actual position. And I've actually done that, and I know that this is where Chris is saying, welcome everybody, you know, it's time for the Q&A session for June the 7th or whenever this was. So I click on the where I want to chop off the front end, and then I use a keyboard shortcut, Shift and J, actually select everything from the start of the recording to the position of the cursor. So you can see now the portion I selected is highlighted in this light blue color. And now if I hit the X scissors, the pair of scissors here, or alternatively I can use Control X to delete, and that will basically make that soundbite go away. So now I can do the same thing. I can drag the slider down to near the end of the recording, and I can find out where I say, see you all next week, and Chris says, that's all folks, thank you very much, and see you later. So again, I click on that, but now this time, because I've only got a short piece of tape to cut, I just click on the position I want, where I want the sound recording to end, drag the mouse to the right, I let go, and that highlights the end of the clip, and again I can just hit the scissors here and make it go away. Alright, so now what I've done is I've trimmed the front and the back end of the sound recording. I've got the recording that I want to put onto the website as the sound recording record, and so now I need to do file and export audio. And that gives me a couple of options. I can share it to a website here. But what I want to do is export it to my computer. So I want to click on export to the computer. So I browse here for my output folder. I rename the clip. It starts off life as an M4A file. I want to change it to be an MP3 because that's basically what we post. So I give it the date, audio, and MP3, and then I have this these controls here, the sample rate, the bit rate, and the quality. I basically I tone those all down, so I make the recording a lot smaller than the original M4A file. And the nice thing about Audacity is it remembers these parameters. So every week when I edit the recording and then save the audio, I get the same settings when I save the file. So I save the original M4A as an MP3. I tell it to export that file. Here's the original M4A recording, which you can see was 54 megabytes and change. And here's the same file as an MP3, or the edited file as an MP3. And you can see it's been knocked down to 7 megabytes. So that's a huge saving in terms of space on our web server. And the, you know, it's audio, so the quality isn't all that bad, I don't think. Nobody's ever complained that it's an awful sound recording. And I think those are quite good parameters. So That's all I have, Chris, on Audacity.
We do have a couple of things in the chat. Elizabeth says, so those two blue lines are the stereo tracks. There are only two for stereo, I guess.
That's correct. Yeah, you got left channel and right channel, top and bottom, the waveforms.
Okay. And Tom just mentioned using LAME to encode audio in MP3 format, if anybody's interested in that. Ed mentions there's a Linux version, as you mentioned. Elizabeth said, I happen to be using Audacity this week to move MP3 files on my USB to my laptop. I'm not sure on that one why, Elizabeth, why you would bother to use Audacity to move files. I would have thought that just using File Explorer to move MP3 files would be easier. I'm not sure.
That's because I have an old audio cassette, and I bought a little thing called a cassette to MP3 converter. I plugged the USB into this little dinky converter thing, and then I put it into the laptop.
Okay, gotcha. You weren't just moving an MP3 file. You were converting from something else to an MP3 and then putting it onto the USB. Okay, makes sense. Linda says, if you're recording music from a video, is it better to keep the M4A for quality?
Oh, yeah. If you want higher quality, then use a different format. That's right.
Okay. But even MP3s can be done at a high bit rate for good quality, right?
Oh, absolutely. But you get a much bigger file.
Yeah. Okay.
So my aim is to cut the file size down and yet maintain reasonable quality.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not sure, Dave, if anybody knows in terms of quality for a given bit rate and so forth, what's the difference between M4A and an MP3 file? Is there any significance in how it actually sounds?
Just while you're asking that question, I just want to clarify, I'm not trying to steal music off the YouTube without paying for it. It happens when I'm looking for music that I'm teaching a dance to, and I can't buy the music on, you know, iTunes or whatever, Spotify. So I just capture it. So I'm looking for the best quality to have it then play in a fairly large room after.
Yeah. Personally, I'm not sure about the differences between M4A and MP3. Certainly MP3 has the ability to do high bit rates and so forth to give a good quality. I don't know if M4A is more compressed than an MP3 or whatever.
M4A is from an MP4 file, a video.
Yeah, but a lot of places like sell music in M4A format.
Well, an MP3 uses the, that's a big long German name. Langerhauser or some whatever it is to encode the thing.
Well, when you buy music, it's M4A. Like if you buy it right off iTunes, it's an M4A. So that's what I've been using. I don't worry about size. I've got lots of space. So I'll stick with that if most people generally think it's the best quality.
Well, personally, I would think that converting is more likely to introduce imperfections than anything else. So going with whatever your original
is. It depends on whether it's lossless or lossy. If you convert to a FLAC file from a WAV file, it's going to be lossless. So it's not going to, it should be bit for bit. If you're converting from an MP3 file, it's already had the MP remove crap. All the compression and everything else is already there.
Yeah. But I'm just thinking, like in Linda's case, she has an M4A file, and is there any benefit to converting that to an
MP3? No, that's not what I'm saying, Chris. I'm saying typically now I just take that video file and convert it, and it just seems to, well, it'll convert it to an MP3, but should I convert them all to an M4A, as Alan was showing, was possible?
Yeah, you want to keep it as low a compression as you can get.
Okay.
So the more times you convert it from one to the other, if it's lossy, you're going to be losing information from it. It's like like VHS tapes. Have you ever copied one VHS to another? after three recordings, by the time you get to the third one, it's not even worth looking at. It's the same with audio.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom mentions in the chat that M4A is a container, not a single codec, and it usually outperforms MP3. So leaving it as an M4A is probably your best bet. But I don't know that it's going to be a significant difference, but yeah. Okay, I think we should probably move on from this now. We beat that to death, maybe. So, next one up is keyboard shortcut number 14. So, again, this is all about not taking your hands off the keyboard and just using keyboard shortcuts rather than reaching over to the mouse, moving it around, and clicking on things. Usually, you'll end up faster as long as you can remember the keyboard shortcut. So the shortcut for this week is to see a calendar for the month. So people are probably aware that if you click on the date and time in the bottom right-hand corner of the system tray, it'll bring up a calendar. And so you can actually get to that without taking your hands off the keyboard by just hitting the Windows key and N, and it'll open up that notifications, which includes the calendar. And you can see the dates and so forth. And then if you do WinN a second time or hit the Escape key, it'll close the calendar. Now, you can actually go beyond that with keeping your hands on the keyboard if you really want to, because if you want to navigate around to different month or different year or anything like that, you can actually use combinations of Tab and Shift Tab, Enter, Arrow keys to navigate through that dialog box to change any of the parameters for it. But quite frankly, at that point, if you want to navigate to another month or something like that, it's probably actually easier at that point to actually use the mouse. And so that's it for the keyboard shortcut of the week.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And the next item is yours, Pooh.
Oh, okay. Yes, indeed. This is an interesting character. I watch his YouTube videos every now and then. And he put up this video saying that Microsoft is finally fixing Windows 11, and it's this channel called CyberCPU Tech, and the guy, quite frankly, is usually not all that happy with Microsoft and Windows, so he's very gleefully pointing out shortcomings in the operating system, but he's not just a basher. He often has solutions to things as well. This one that he brought up, he went through some of the changes that are in the preview builds that are available for the for Windows 11. And so some of the changes that we'll see coming in probably the 26H2 build of Windows in the fall. Start menu flexibility. So they've been messing around to, I think, really bad effect with the Windows 11 start menu from comparing it to Windows 10 start menu. So they keep changing things, and it looks like they're finally coming back to offering a lot of the functionality and so forth that is actually in the Windows 10 start menu. So he calls it cleaning up the mess. So all of those different areas, recent, recommended, all and so forth, you'll be able to turn more of them on and off and customize them to your heart's content. Taskbar placement. We're going to go back to where they used to allow you to actually have the taskbar on the left side of the screen, the right side of the screen, or the top of the screen, or continue to do this on the bottom. So they're finally going to get that all back for those that like to have those different placements. Improved search, and this is one I think a lot of people will get hit with to the benefit, is if you're doing search, often what you're doing is trying to search on your local computer. A lot of people will just jump to a web browser or whatever if they're searching on the internet. Well, the current version of search, it comes up immediately with all kinds of hits that it finds on the internet as opposed to local. So they are going to prioritize local results over top of internet results. Context menus, they're going to be rearranging them and reorganizing them and making them maybe a little bit more logical. Low latency profile is intended to make sure that the user interface remains as responsive as possible. And what it will do is as you click on things to, say, bring up the start menu or a context menu or something like that, they will actually steal CPU activity away from other applications that are running on your computer to give it over to the user interface for those tenths of a second or whatever that will help with making things feel more responsive in the user interface. ReadyPrint is a new technology they've come up with, which will include the ability to print directly to more printers without having to install a specific printer driver for that printer. I think there will still be a need for, or there will be available, specific printer drivers for printers, because I think this ReadyPrint is not going to include all of the functionality in all printers that are out there. So you may still want to print to using a printer driver created by the manufacturer, but you may not need to in order to get basic printing functionality. Touchpad enhancements, and I didn't really understand what was going on in there. And more consistent dialog boxes. One of the things that bugs me about Windows is that a lot of the dialog boxes act differently. And these are Windows own user interface portions and that. And they look different, they act different, and so forth. So apparently they're bringing more consistency there. So that's it for that one. And I will paste into the chat the link to that.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So the Cyber CPU guy isn't terribly happy with Windows, and someone else isn't terribly happy with Windows either. This turns out to be just an annoyance. Every now and then this thing would pop up telling me that Proton VPN couldn't find its server. I thought this was kind of annoying more than anything else, but as you'll find out, it wasn't actually a Windows problem. Anyway, we'll get to that in just a second. So as usual, I went and asked my favorite Microsoft chatbot, Microsoft Copilot, how do I stop this pop-up keep coming up in Windows 10? And it says, well, basically it's either notifications or the Proton app's trying to launch itself, and I can disable that. So it gives me all kinds of ways to do it. Here's how to disable the notification in the browser, how to disable the pop-ups, how to block Proton in Windows, and then if it still pops up, then you can look at the browser cache, network changes, and third-party applications. So I followed the bouncing ball on all of those things, and basically nothing happened. And one of the other problems was that when this thing pops up, it only lasts for a brief period of time, you know, just a second or two. And by the time I remembered that what I should be doing is hit the Windows key and print screen to grab a screen image of this pop-up toast, it's already gone away. But I found out that you can go to settings and ease of access and then the display option, and you can change show notifications and have it do it for 5 minutes. The only trouble is that this pop-up toast for this Proton VPN thing, even though I tell it to show it for 5 minutes, it doesn't show it for 5 minutes. So I still had to be quick on the draw at some point to get that image. Anyway, eventually I did. And trying to disable the toast wasn't working very well, so I said, how do I remove Proton completely from Windows 10? Well, uninstall the app, manually delete some folders, registry entries, all kinds of wonderful things. And once you've done all those, then you reboot, and that will finalize the removal of all Proton software on my system. Except, of course, the next time I reboot, or shortly thereafter, I find a pop-up toast which says that the VPN can't reach its server. And I didn't remember. I went back to my maintenance log, and I couldn't find where I'd installed Proton VPN. So I wasn't very surprised that I couldn't find it to uninstall it. But then I'm thinking, well, why is this thing popping up? It's somewhere on the system, but it's not installed. What can it possibly be? And eventually, I think somebody's got in the chat here. Vivaldi seems to install. Yeah, that was the trick eventually. I realized that the new version of Vivaldi, or several versions ago, I don't know, they introduced Proton VPN as an optional virtual private network in this browser. Now, I don't actually use it, so the thing's sitting there, and I never hit this button here to make it do something. But if I go to Vivaldi's settings and look for the security path, the privacy and security, then I can see that by default, enabling the VPN in the browser has actually been checked. So clearly what I need to do, since I'm not going to use, or if I want to use the VPN, then I will go into the settings, enable it, and then click on that button on the homepage to make it work. But for most of the time, I don't use the VPN, so I just uncheck this enable button, and that basically makes everything go away. So there was a Windows annoyance that was actually my fault for installing Vivaldi. It had nothing really to do with Windows whatsoever. So I can't rant about that one, Chris, sorry.
Well, that's all right. I'll just remind you the next time you have a problem that you want to blame on Windows, that, maybe see if there's some other cause for it. So.
Okay, next up is you.
Yeah, I'm kind of weird. I like reading security reports that are put out by companies and things like that. Usually there's some interesting stats or trends and things like that that I'm kind of interested in. And I came across this one, the FBI Internet Crime Report for 2025. And it has tons and tons of stats in this one here. Some of the highlights that I pulled out that I thought were kind of interesting: complaints by year are at an all-time high of over 1 million complaints in a year. That's quite a few. And losses by year also at an all-time high of over $20 billion. Now, I presume this is focused only on the U.S. Seniors, people 60 or older, lead the number of complaints and losses. This next one I was kind of puzzled by, sextortion, which I always thought of as the young folks who are sending around dick pics and things like that and getting caught up by it. Half as many in the 60-plus group as the under-20s. So somehow these 60-plus group, they're getting caught up in sextortions. So interesting. But the losses in the 60-plus group were over 10 times the under-20. And I assume that's because the under-20s don't have any money, whereas the people in the 60-plus actually do have money. In reported cyber threats, SIM swap was 10%, which I thought was really, really high. When you think of what's involved in doing a SIM swap, is you have to actually contact the provider for your victim and convince that provider that, I'm this person, I lost my phone, please transfer my number to this new device. And so I thought this was a really high number, kind of puzzling. And then call center fraud had losses over $2.9 billion. So that's the one where people calling you up and saying, there's problems with your computer and we can fix it for you. Lots of more interesting stats on it as well. So an interesting read. And so you might want to check it out. And I have pasted the URL into the chat.
Chris, I wonder if that sextortion thing for the over 60s is a real crime. Or is it one of these scam things where you get the email which says, we've got pictures from your webcam, and if you don't send us money, we'll post it on the internet to all your friends and relatives?
Oh, that could be the case. I didn't actually consider that. They didn't go into real details about it, but that would make sense, yeah.
I think it's more kind of you have there's Russian wives available for you, that kind of sextortion.
That might be, yeah. Okay. Might not be as odd as I first thought of it to be.
Yeah, I saw one report, Tom, where one guy got caught twice in that same scam.
Oh, jeez.
That's really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can post my nude butt anywhere they want, and I'll take two Russian brides. Thank you.
I'm going to say it's AI. It's an AI-generated scam, so go away.
You have to pay for their airfare ahead of time.
I remember reading that there was some guy who got this thing that, we have all these compromising photos of you in sexual enterprises or exploits and things like that, and he had to pay up, and he says, oh, he says, I can you send them to all my friends? None of them believe that I'm sexually active.
Okay, next up is yours too, Chris.
Okay. Boy, I'm up and up and up. Okay, Paul Perrott. He's been writing about Windows for over 30 years. He's written over 30 books, most of them on Windows. And smart guy, and he's a really easy read, and I really like the way that he presents information. And he has a blog posting up on hardware device basics. And this one I found really fascinating because I don't know why I put it in YouTube Tech because it's actually on, I'm pretty sure it's just a web page. At any rate, he goes through all of the places in Windows where you can deal with hardware. And he goes into all of the configuration options and in some cases why you'd want to choose one over the other or how you can, you know, customize it to, you know, work a certain way and things like that. So really good, right from connecting a device through the different technologies that are used and so forth. Now, at the end of it, it sort of fades out as all of his stuff that is behind paywalls. It fades out, and then beyond that, you can't read anything unless you are part of the Thorot Lite or Thorot Premium. So that ends up costing you money. But his articles usually have an enormous amount of information before you hit the paywall. So I decided it was worth posting just for the information that you can see. It's several pages worth of information that he has up there before you hit the paywall. And if you want to pay, $10 US, we'll get you Thorot Lite, which will allow you to read in total, the total article for 3 premium articles per month. And then if you want the premium, that gets you unlimited premium articles at US $70 a year. So read at least his articles that you can read for free. And if you decide that you really like his writing, you might want to consider whether you want to pay for his Thorot Lite or Thorot Premium. That's it for that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so one of the other things people wanted to know about a while ago was cleaning up files on a, or making space on a on an Android device, on a smartphone, basically, smartphone or tablet, I guess. And your options here are a bit limited. As with lots of proprietary operating systems, Android locks down a lot of system files and folders, so you can't even see what's there, never mind actually remove anything. But there are some places that you can actually eliminate things and gain up quite a bit of space. However, it's Android, so there's no easy button, as it were. You have to look at a whole bunch of different things, and a lot of it has to be done using manual processing. And if you don't know anything about the Android file system, which is a mystery to a lot of people, I point you to this article which I did a number of years ago, 2021. It's a series of articles on the file system for Android. And basically what I did was I took an old phone, I rooted it so I could get to the actual file system, the entire file system, and then I did a lot of exploring in the file system to figure out what things were. So this is kind of a review of a lot of that kind of stuff. So it will tell you what you can do and what you can't do with Android's file system. Now recently I came across this YouTube video, 6 hacks to clear Android storage and create lots of space. And it's quite good. A few of the things I wouldn't actually do, but some of them are pretty basic and you can actually use them to generate space on your Android device. So if you want to jump ahead in my little mini series here, there's going to be a second part, I think, and you can see what this guy at least has to offer. So Android isn't really very consistent. Depending on the make and model of your phone, menu items jump around all over the place. So what we're really looking for is storage. Where is stuff stored and what is stored and what can we get to and what what can we get to, basically? In my case, storage is actually under settings and then battery and device care. Now, sometimes it's just called device care and sometimes it's just called storage. And so you have to look on your settings and try and figure out. But if you search for storage in the settings menu, you've got this little search bar thing up here, you can search for storage and it will probably find what we want. So here we are, here's the storage on my system. 62% of the available space on the, this is the internal memory of the phone, 62% is used, so 40 gig of 64 gigabytes nominal is already in use. So I got about 20 gig free kind of thing, so I've got lots of space, so I really shouldn't be worried about it. If I dig down a bit there, so if I actually click on storage here, it will bring up this page and tell me about how the internal storage is broken out. So you can see I've got 100 meg or so in photographs. I don't have any videos. The big things are right here. The applications are 22 gig and the system files are 18 gig. So what's that? 20, 30, 40 gigabytes of space is actually being used by Android itself. So I don't actually have very much I can really get to there. Some of the stuff you can actually get to and remove, but some of it, especially if it's system related, then as I said earlier, it's locked down and you can't get to it. So let's start with the easy things we can do. And a program that I really like, an application, is CX File Explorer. It's available from the Play Store, and it's basically a file manager. It lets you look at the main storage, SD card if you've got one, show you what's in your downloads folder. You go to library, that shows you images and videos, documents, and if you have a local area network, then you can actually get to files and folders on the network. So it's a really useful file manager. And one of the things it does is it lets you get to the recycle bin. So if you open up the recycle bin, you can see that I've got 76 megabytes of files. These are all JPEG files. If I hit the more key, then you can see I've got a whole raft of JPEG files here. And they're all screenshots, so they're things that I've taken pictures of, so I can use them in PowerPoint slides. And June the 20th, so I've pretty clearly finished with those by now. So what I can do now is I can just click on one of these guys. Once I select one of them, then I get the option right here. This icon means select all. So I can click on select all. That selects everything in that folder. And now I can do a permanently delete. Remember, this is a recycle bin, so when we delete the files, now it's not going to go to the recycle bin, it's going to trash them completely from the computer. So that's one way to clean things up. Another way is, because a lot of the things were images, I can actually go to that local area, pick up images, find the camera icon, and then I can see all the pictures I've got. And here I've highlighted a bunch of pictures that I don't need anymore. And I've told it, all right, I want you to delete all the selected files. So select the ones I want, just the ones I want, leave everything else in place, tell it to delete. Now it says, are you sure you want to delete? Yes, I'm sure. But now notice that if I check this box, it will permanently delete them rather than send the deleted files to the recycle bin. So I can save time and effort. If I really know I want to get rid of them, I can delete them permanently at this point and just make them all go away. CX File Explorer has another neat thing here. Notice you've got this clean button. And you can see here's my images and audio files and stuff there. It's giving me a quick breakdown. But if I hit clean, then it gives me some options here. So I can access the recycle bin, cache files, and unused applications. So if I look at the recycle bin, here's that 76 megabytes of JPEG files again. And now rather than frig around trying to, find one and highlight them all and all that kind of stuff, I can just say, okay, empty the recycle bin, and they will all go away. And I can do the same thing with the cache files. Right? I've got only 5 megabytes of cache files. But cache files are, as far as I'm concerned, they're temporary files. They're really no use. I mean, cache files are when you load something onto your system, it caches the file. So if you load the same thing another time, it can get it from memory cache rather than have to go out to the disk file, open it up and reload it. And the neat thing about cache files is, even if you delete them all right now, make them all go away, if you need them again in future, it will rebuild a cache as it goes along. So I'm happy to make all those go away by doing clear as well. And the final thing it will let me do is it will let me look at what it calls unused applications. And because now I'm getting a bit more heavyweight stuff, I got 2.5 gigabytes of so-called unused applications. However, you notice that one of them is Zoom, and that may or may not be a good thing. If this is your device that you use to access the club's Q&A sessions, you probably don't want to remove Zoom. However, in my case, here's the unused apps. Now, as I said, it calls them unused apps, but that's not what it means, because down here, for example, is the Explore file manager, which is a twin pane file manager. Here is a thing called Nature Counts. Here is Tailgun Charlie, which is an Android game, which I play very infrequently. I use Nature Counts very infrequently. I use Explore not very much, but I do use these things. I just haven't used them recently, and that's what CX File Explorer means when it says unused. It means you didn't use these things recently. So now I can have a look at this list and I can decide what do I want to go away. Well, Zoom on my phone was just a plaything. I don't actually use my phone for Zoom, so I can check that guy. LG ThinQ was a thin client for a television. And I've got a perfectly nice remote control, so I don't use my phone to do that. Seeing AI was an application that Jeff Dubois recommended I should have a look at. I looked at it. Again, it's not something that I would use a lot. So a bunch of these things I can basically check. All right, and get rid of this one. I don't use this emoji editor. I don't use Google Photos at all. DecoPic, whatever that is. So I can just tell it to uninstall those guys. And when I do that, it says, you want to uninstall the app? Well, yes, I do. Do I want to keep the data? Well, if I'm going to uninstall the app, I'm quite happy to let it uninstall the data. So I can leave that unchecked and just say, okay. So now, if you recall, before I started this game, I had 39 gig of space being used. Now I've got 37 gig of space being used. So by basically deleting the applications and a few cache files and images and that kind of stuff, I've saved myself a couple of gigabytes, which is, it's not that huge when you consider I've got 20 gig free, but every little helps sometimes. So next time we'll take another look at apps and cache and data and see some of the other things that we can do along those lines. So that's all I have on that, Chris.
Okay, thanks, Alan. In the chat, Cal says he found that Malwarebytes, which is a free app for Android, has an easy button for cleaning an Android cell phone. So you could check that out. We have Tom mentioned that if you're trying to uninstall an app, you can actually do it right from the home screen. Long press hold on an app and drag it to uninstall at the top of the screen.
He must have seen my slides before, too.
Oh, okay. And Cal pointed out another app from the Google Play Store, Files to SD Card Utility for file management. So I presume that's if you have an SD card in there, you can move a bunch of stuff to the SD card from your built-in storage. And that's all we have in the chat.
And I noticed one here. Tom says, no problem, just get a phone with 1 terabyte.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, so as I said earlier, I thought we would have time for questions, and we're in the last 10. We're actually in the last 15, I think. So if anybody has any other questions, any comments, anything you'd like to share right now, we have some time.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
So I recently changed from the Samsung messages to the Google messages because I got a new phone and it doesn't come with Samsung messages anymore. And like a ding-dong, I did not back up all my stuff and just assumed that it would go over, as they said, and I lost the complete, like, everything from my brother, who is now deceased, and I have some of it that I had downloaded, but it's all gone. Like, nothing's there. And when I went back to the Samsung on my old phone, it's not there either. I don't understand what happened. And with other people, there are gaps, like months of nothing on the Google messages, but when I go back to Samsung, they're there. Like, I don't know if it has to do with the contacts or what. Like, I don't know if anybody's had any experience with this, but I'm not happy and I don't know what to do.
Seems odd that messages would disappear from both a new phone and...
Well, it's really the app, because when I went to the Google Messages app on my old phone, it was the same. Like, it had to do with the app. It wasn't the phone. I'm not sure. So, yeah, I have gaps. I have one missing altogether. It's just weird.
But you had two apps. You had Samsung Messages and Google Messages. Now, has Samsung basically transferred all of their files to Google Messages?
Yeah, that's what was supposed to happen. Because the newer phones, like for the past 2 years, the Samsung phones are not loaded with Samsung messages. They're loaded with Google messages.
Right.
So I thought, well, I have now a new phone, and I can't use the Samsung messages on it, so I'll transfer everything over, and it didn't do what it was supposed to do. And I don't know. I think I'm missing something. I don't know. It's weird. So nobody else has migrated over, and
is nothing of that stored on a drive, the Google Drive, the messages or anything like that?
No, it was my Samsung messages that were transferred to Google.
And there was no cloud backup of any kind?
No.
Do you still have your Samsung phone?
I do, and all the messages from my brother are now gone. Like, it's as if I never had any communication with him at all.
Who's the provider for your Samsung?
Rogers.
So can Rogers' office help you with that?
Sorry?
If you take your phone to the Rogers facility, can they help you?
I don't know. Maybe not.
It's worth a trip. Yep.
Okay, thanks. Yep.
So are you thinking, Harvey, that they may have messages on their server still?
Well, usually the only people that I've talked to about this, they said, well, Bell helps me with my phone. That's where she bought it. And so in Roger's case, I'm sure that if you go back to their office and explain, you know, perhaps they can help you find the data or, you know, at least give you some insight as to what can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as the phone goes, like, I bought the phone not from them. They only have plans. And so, yeah, maybe not.
But if the provider, that's a good point, that maybe they can help you. And I certainly, anytime that I've had to call Rogers, their tech support people are usually pretty good. I've run into some that were dolts that didn't know anything, but I've run into some people who were very knowledgeable. And so possibly as the carrier, they might be able to help you.
It's worthwhile asking. Don't phone support. You go right into their office. There's satellite offices wherever you can find it, and get them to help you there.
Well, I will caution you about going into their offices, quote unquote. They have a big Rogers store at College Square at Baseline Woodruff, and it turns out that that's not a Rogers store at all. Even though it's got a big Rogers store sign out front. Everybody is dressed in Rogers clothing, and everything in the store has to do with Roger, but they're actually a third party. And
don't store them.
Yeah, I found this, and I found it really surprising. I thought this was false advertising, quite frankly. But one time I was asking them something, and they were saying, oh, well, you'll have to call in about that because we have no insight into that. Well, it turns out the reason why they have no insight into it is because they're not connected to any of the Rogers systems at all. They're wireless wave or something like that, one of these third-party carriers. So that's the only caution I'll have about that. You might want to ask them as you walk in the door, say, are you really a Rogers outlet or are you a third party?
That's wild. Okay, so Richard has his hand up.
Yeah. I remember historically you had a choice with an SD card of setting up as external storage or extending the memory. But I don't know how common that is, but I've never been able to get the extending the memory option to work.
Yeah, no, I would never use it as a second drive, basically.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's all I ever knew it to be available, but I never really delved into it to see if you could just extend the storage, because everything I always saw talked about you could move things like programs from the internal storage to the SD card and things like that, but you couldn't actually just add it to the internal storage.
Yeah. If you were extending the memory, then you couldn't take out the SD card and use it as a separate storage base because of the way it was formatted. But I gather it's not a common option, but it would have been quite useful.
Yeah, that would be really useful.
Has anybody on the call actually done that? Used an SD card as an extended storage for the main memory?
Well, you're not going to be running programs from it if that's what you're trying to do.
Why not? I tried it with my I have a TV with Android TV, and but I found that it didn't work, at least with a 128 gigabyte USB drive.
Well, it's not recommended, Tom.
I agree.
It's good for storing files and pictures and all the rest of it. But you don't want to run programs from it.
Is it strictly a speed issue, Harvey? That this card to be slower? Or?
I lost track of Android. I've switched over to iPhone for so long now, but back then that wasn't recommended that you run programs off those storage devices.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't see anything else in the chat, so if anybody else has questions, or you can throw it in the chat real quick, or you could turn on your microphone or put your hand up.
In the meantime, I'll go into the wrap-up slides here. So just a reminder for everybody, if you're not a member of the club, you can subscribe to two of our Google groups. One is the announcements group, OPCUG announcements, and if you subscribe to that by sending an email to the link right there, then you will receive a couple of messages a week generally. One gets sent out by Chris on the weekend, and reminds you what's going on in terms of the next meeting. And then I will send one out an hour before the meeting starts, just as a final reminder that we're about to get going. So not very onerous in terms of emails, but hopefully useful to some people at least at some times. And our newsletter is always available to you on the website, but if you want to receive a bright, shiny PDF copy of your very own, then you can subscribe to our newsletter, Google Group, and every month, Bridget, our editor, our hardworking newsletter editor, will send you an email with a PDF file attached, which will be the current issue of the newsletter. Now, we have our weekly Q&A session, which is always open to anybody who wants to ask a question. But if you want 24/7 service, then you have to be a member, and we have a members-only forum, which is basically an online question-and-answer group, where you can receive emails, people, you can post emails, post questions, and people in that group will generally reply within a short period of time, actually, and you may get the answer to your question without having to wait a week. But as I say, that is available only to members of the club, so you have to join the club if you want to be part of that members forum. Now, just in general, what do you need to know? You've seen the kind of things we do at Q&A. Lots of times we have questions and answers and shares and interesting things, but we only tell you about the things that we think you need to know, the things that you ask us that you want to know. So if you need to know anything about software, operating systems, hardware components, anything computer related, send us a question to our suggestion box email address, and we'll be happy to answer your questions, research the answer, whatever. Another way that we reach out and touch someone is through our presentations at the library. And there's a bunch of presentations coming up, but they're essentially on two topics. And you want to know anything about electronic mail, Chris has all the ins and outs. And he's going to be doing that very frequently in the next week or so, four different locations, all kinds of different times of day and evening. So if you can find a branch and a time that suits you, then just go to the URL at the bottom of the page there, register for the session, and Chris will tell you everything you need to know about email. And if you want to be able to organize and show your photographs to all your friends and relatives in an efficient and orderly manner, Linda at the main branch of the library on Saturday the 27th, 2 o'clock, has her organizing and showcasing your photographs presentation. Again, you have to register at the URL there. And that same URL will tell you all of the presentations that the club, Chris and Linda, are going to be giving at the library's branches all over the city in the next little while. Okay, so is there anything else in the chat?
Yeah, we do have something from Elizabeth. The exercise class instructor uses Bluetooth, she thinks, to run the music for, to the group, and sometimes it is wonky. She says the problem is due to her leaving some apps open, so she closes down all apps and Bluetooth seems to work. What is Bluetooth doing? Searching through the running apps for music to play? That's really odd, that because Bluetooth can work with multiple devices all at the same time.
It's not a Zoom class, is it?
No, no.
Okay.
I found on my Android phone, it's a Pixel, that when I start up Bluetooth, it automatically, Podcast Addict says, has a setting where it automatically starts if you attach a Bluetooth audio device. But so what I have to do is I just go into the app that I want, in this case Libby, and start that, and then the Podcast Addict shuts up.
Hmm. That's interesting. So maybe it's as simple as the instructor getting the focus on the right app rather than switching away to another app. I don't know. Yeah, very odd.
Does it just open all the apps you've ever had linked to a Bluetooth device on that phone or on that device that she's using to play the Bluetooth from?
I'm gonna ask her next time I see her what she's doing, because she says that she's not trying to play music off any other app than the one that she's using to broadcast, but. Anyway, I'll check and I'll get back to everybody.
Okay, all right. So if there are other questions or if you have topics that you'd like to share, as usual, just send a few details to suggestion box at opcug.ca and we will be happy to add your question or share to next week's agenda. So next week is our next Q&A. This will be July the 1st. We're rushing through the year already. So I hope you enjoyed tonight's presentations, and we'll see you all next Wednesday.
Thanks, folks. See you next Wednesday.